This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich, and I'm here with David Canfield.
Hi.
Richard Lawson and Rebecca Ford have left us both for Europe, actually, which is not nice. So we're joined by Chris Murphy. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Excited to do the work of two people today.
Why aren't you in Europe is the question. Why aren't we all in Europe?
That's an amazing question.
I've been asking myself that frequently this month. But Chris, you're back just in time because we're closing out our Pride Month flashbacks, which you were here to kick off with us. It's been such a great month of looking back at these movies. And we're closing with, I think, the only movie you can close a Pride Oscar flashback series with. It's Moonlight. But first, we're going to talk about some news that's out there, including about the Oscars, about the Golden Globes, and about festival season, which is right around the corner. David, you got to write the exciting news, niche but exciting news, that the Knives Out sequel, Glass Onion, will have its world premiere at the Toronto Film Festival, which I think we had speculated might happen. Knives Out premiered there in 2019, but I'm excited. How about you?
Yeah, I'm excited. We'd heard yesterday that there was a world premiere announcement coming today, which was the first for the fall festivals. And you rightly speculated that it would be Glass Onion because, of course, Knives Out premiered at TIFF. One of the, I think, biggest world premiere launches at TIFF over the last several years, just in terms of kicking off there before going on to have an incredibly successful box office run, really strong critical acclaim, and an Oscar nomination for screenplay, and nearly got into Best Picture as well. So Netflix, which is now handling this new movie, the first one was distributed by Lionsgate, clearly knows that playbook worked, and they're going to try to make lightning strike twice.
Yeah, it's really crazy to realize that seeing Knives Out at TIFF in 2019 was like one of my last pre-COVID movie-going memories.
Wow.
Because
Same.
It feels like that was ages ago. I mean, it really was ages ago. It's kind of crazy looking at the Audience Award winners from that year. Jojo Rabbit won the Audience Award, which isn't that surprising. It's a crowd pleaser. And then it was Marriage Story and Parasite, all Best Picture nominees. Knives Out totally should have been the Audience Award winner that year.
Yeah, and a couple of those movies are more, definitely more divisive than I feel like your average TIFF People's Choice winner is. Particularly,
yeah.
I mean, Jojo Rabbit was, I remember out of TIFF, there were definitely people who loved it, but that was not a slam dunk, this movie is on its way to winning Oscars kind of deal at that moment, at least.
So now knowing that the TIFF announcements and the festival announcements are going to be coming, you know, we're heading into the 4th of July holiday week here, but in Venice, they'll probably get ready to announce things. I was eyeing the trailer for See How They Run, the Searchlight film that came out today as well. It's got Saoirse Ronan, Sam Rockwell. It's kind of a murder mystery at a West End theater. It's got a release date of September 30th. Maybe we get two murder mysteries at TIFF this year.
Yeah, I think that it's nice to see TIFF pretty much guaranteed, from what I can have been told and what I can gather, to make a really big splash again, finally. It's first post-COVID, and having two blockbuster murder mystery comedies is exactly the way I'd want to see it done.
Yeah, I just the idea of sitting in a TIFF audience, David, you and I will both be there. We've both been before, and the TIFF crowds are, you know, get media from all over the world. But a lot of people just live in Toronto and love movies, and the energy can be, you can't get it anywhere else. So a movie like Glass Onion just feels so perfect for it.
I miss it. I'm so excited.
Me too.
Looking at this cast for See How They Run, I had no idea this was happening. And it's Saoirse Ronan, Sam Rockwell, David Oyelowo, Adrian Brody, Ruth Wilson. It's very sort of like giving Glass Onion a run for its money in terms of starry murder whodunit cast. I'm really...
It's giving Glass Onion, it's giving Murder on the Orient Express. It's somehow finding its way between the two.
I remember when White Lotus season 2 and Glass Onion casts were coming together around the same time, and it was impossible to remember who was in which. And now I think See How They Run's going to be added to that. Like, knowing who was in which starry murder mystery cast is going to be impossible.
Place Aubrey Plaza correctly.
I can't do it. Someday I will. Today is not that day. Okay, David, in other news that you've been writing about for us, the Academy announced its new slate of members, which is always a really exciting time to kind of see who they're paying attention to, see the recent Oscar nominees or winners who get in the club. You know, Ariana DeBose, I think no one doubted that she was going to be a new Academy member. But you and I both noticed that there were some people who had Oscar buzz last year but didn't get nominated who got their seat at the table.
Yeah, it's always something that the Academy does to an extent, but it did feel like... Our months long updated prediction lists that the Academy just sort of scrolled through them, checked off lots of people who narrowly missed out on nominations. Both of the Belfast actors, Katrina Balf and Jamie Dornan, were invited to join the Academy. The two who were not nominated, I should say. Renata Reinsvay from Worst Person in the World, who did get a BAFTA nomination. It was interesting. There was a lot of leaning toward who international groups recognized this past award season, which makes sense given the direction of the Academy. Once again, the list of this year's invitees is half people not from the United States, over a third people of color, almost half women. So definitely the same kind of trends we've been seeing the last few years with the Academy committing to a changed sort of membership and seeing what comes of that in terms of its nominations and winners.
Yeah, I was excited to see Robin De Jesus, who had this great breakout role in Tick, Tick, Boom. And we featured him in our Phase 1 Oscar issue, kind of knowing he was a long shot contender. But it's nice to see that someone else was noticing his great work. Chris, who were you excited to see?
I'm super excited to see Andrew Ahn, who directed Fire Island, which was, you know, we've talked a lot about on this podcast. I'm super excited for him. I mean, I'm like surprised by some of Jesse Plemons getting in there finally. I mean, he had his Oscar nomination for Power of the Dog, but I would have assumed that he might have been in,
he's
you know,
been before. In like 8 Best Picture nominees.
Yeah.
This was overdue. He's been in too many Best Picture nominees. This was like... Yeah.
To not be in, but and Reed Birney, personally, as a theater person, I think Reed Birney, he was in Mass this year, and he's, you know, has a long-standing theater career, and he's made it in. And
Cheryl Lee Ralph, theater legend.
Abbott Elementary queen, Cheryl Lee Ralph. So.
Thank God for Abbott Elementary to finally get her in there.
Yeah.
I would assume that was what did it.
A TV show, getting you into the Academy, what comes next? but it really does, looking at the list, it's inspiring. It's like, oh, wow. Actually, a lot of names that I don't know, that I've never heard of, but a lot of names I'm like, oh, wow. Like, this is actually, I feel like it bodes well for hopefully nominations and winners to come. But I really do want to see Billie Eilish's ballot. I hope somebody gets their hands on it next year, because that is important to me. I want to see what she's checking off.
Yeah, also in the music department, it's exciting to see Dan Romer, who composed pieces of Southern Wild and then also Station 11 this past year. And also, speaking of Knives Out 2, Nathan Johnson, cousin to Ryan Johnson, and who composed Knives Out, I assume is doing Glass Onion and also Nightmare Alley. He seems like an overdue member.
Yes. He did not even make the shortlist for Nightmare Alley, which was quite controversial.
Wow.
Yeah, see, they're just making up for past wrongs by inviting people in the Academy. I mean, you look at this list. This is 397 people, and we talk about Academy members all the time and what the Academy likes and what they don't like. And I think this small sample of who's in it is just a constant reminder of, like, this is a wide, wide-ranging group of people. And thinking that they all can think the same thing is foolish. The whole point is to get as wide a range of people as possible to pick the best of the year.
Yep. And I also like the focus particularly on talent from last year's international contenders, really trying to put, you know, the star of Drive My Car and A Hero and the cinematographer of The Hand of God into the Academy and into the, you know, the conversation of where the Oscars are going, because that's the best representative you can get of how to become a global cinema organization. And that really is, this year's list really is, I think, reflective of that.
Yeah, in the directing category, you've got both the director of Lunana, A Yak in the Classroom, and the director of Flea, who have been invited, which is more proof of what you're saying.
And Hamaguchi drive my car too, so which is great.
Yeah. I always went, because Hamaguchi is one of several people who was nominated by two different branches because he was nominated by directing and writing. And I always just wonder how they, because they get to choose for themselves, right, about which branch they join.
Yeah, they get to choose. I was relieved Sean Hader also got invited from both because she was nominated for writing Coda and ultimately won, but was not nominated for directing it. Whereas Risuke Hamaguchi was nominated for both writing and directing Drive My Car. So that's more typical. But yeah, I think I usually go with directing. I think that's sort of the default.
Next time we interview one of these people, we have to ask them and get the answer.
Yes.
Well, let's turn to a different awards body entirely. David, you and I were discussing this Variety piece about the battle for and against the Golden Globes, I guess, is a way to describe it. Where basically, there's like two camps of Hollywood publicists and people working with them who want the Globes to go away forever and then who kind of want them to stick around. And it seems to be a little bit of an impasse. Like, there, no one quite knows if it's going to stay or go at this point. How did it get to this point, David?
There seems to be a lot going on that we're not necessarily privy to, but that seems to be going, frankly, beyond the actual value and controversy of the Golden Globes. Mm. The Variety piece not so subtly hinted at some disagreement between powerful publicist factions in Hollywood. Of course, there was a really strong push on the part of a certain contingent of publicists to push back against the Golden Globes when the controversies really first started mounting, and calling out the alleged treatment of various clients and things like that. So that definitely made sense and was a pretty clear side at the beginning of all of this, but now it feels a lot more muddled. Another interesting element that I thought came out of that Variety piece was NBC perhaps identifying an opportunity to redefine the terms of their agreement with the HFPA and the Golden Globes. It's no secret that awards shows generally are down in the ratings. It's hard to see how the Golden Globes could fully reclaim the glory it had, even though it does have strong brand recognition. And so that also seems to be at play here, is them playing a little bit of hardball and not committing to anything just yet. And I mean, I'll just say in the past week, I've spoken to a couple studio sources, but two particularly. The first one said, there's no way the Golden Globes are happening this year. And the second said, it'll be interesting to see what happens with the Golden Globes this year, because they're probably coming back. So nobody knows anything. And I can't say I know much more than them based on all that. So it's a mess.
What would you put your money on? Are they coming back or not?
I feel like there is enough investment at this point for them to come back in some shape or form. But I think it's coming down to NBC more than we realize in terms of, you know, on both sides of it, right? I think they need assurances that there's going to be enough talent that would make people watch. And then the talent probably isn't going to do it without that national platform. So that's, I think, ultimately where the standstill is, even though so much of the noise right now is around intra-Hollywood bickering, really. Mm.
Chris, do you care if the Golden Globes come back?
I love drama, so I'm like, bring it back, you know? Let's shake things up a bit. But I do feel that we don't really need them as much as other awards bodies, you know, the TCAs and things like that, sort of step up and whatnot. I will say, from the Variety piece, the line that gave me most pause and was like, I don't know if actually we should bring them back, is hearing that Mark Wahlberg sat for an exclusive HFPA interview to promote his Sony Pictures release, Father Stew. So that, if that's where we're trending, I don't know, maybe we don't need it anymore.
If anyone's going to break your boycott,
it will be Father Stew.
I keep seeing that reference and I'm like, I don't know that Mark Wahlberg breaking the boycott for Father Stew indicates Hollywood's ready to jump back into bed. I'm just not sure that that's sufficient evidence. We need a little bit more than that, guys.
Yeah, we got to have a little bit more than that to get me back on board fully. But
I mean, I think the thing that I keep learning is that even if I think the Golden Globes could go away, no one would miss it that much. It can get replaced by SAG and Critics' Choice. There are enough powerful people in Hollywood who think the Golden Globes have, and not that they are important, but that they are recognizable and that they have a visibility that you can't replace with something else, which might be what empowers it to come back.
But yeah, I guess to David's point, though, it's like all these award shows are sort of falling in the visibility department anyway. So, you know, I don't know. I think maybe the Golden Globes are. They've sung their last song.
Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, with the help of Dan Adler and Olivia Nuzzi, we're going inside the media circus swirling around Donald Trump's criminal trial.
People want coverage of Donald Trump. There are sort of shades of 2015, 2016. I found it to be a total break from the reaction to a lot of Trump coverage in the last 2 years.
Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
So let's go into our final Pride flashback of June, which is Moonlight. Not really chosen by anyone. It just kind of felt like it was the inevitable place to end this conversation. It is the only film we're discussing this month that has won Best Picture. It is the only, like, I guess the definition of an LGBTQ film is up for debate, but I would say it is the only one to win Best Picture. Directed by Barry Jenkins. You hear it at the beginning of every episode of the show because it famously was not announced as a Best Picture winner until it was. And I think the only reason I hesitated to go back to Moonlight was because it felt really recent. Like, this podcast existed in the Oscar season when Moonlight was in the running. And I'll talk later about going back and listening to some of those episodes. And Chris, maybe for you, because you have, I don't know if you were covering movies professionally at this point. Did it feel as recent for you, a young person that you are, as it did for me? Did it feel like a like really diving back into the past, revisiting Moonlight?
I was not covering movies professionally when Moonlight won back in 2016, 2017. I guess was the Oscars were in 2017 that year. So that was five years ago. And I was honestly shocked by revisiting because it feels like a movie that, like, there are certain parts of it that stay with me and that, like, were so easy to remember and were so near and dear to my heart. But rewatching it, like, it has been, you know, almost half a decade, or a little bit over half a decade since this came out. And there was a lot that I sort of, I don't want to say missed the first time, but it didn't feel as immediate. I felt the space that has sort of happened between 2016 and now since it came out. And it wasn't as immediate as I thought, which was sort of lovely. It actually is definitely worth revisiting. I was sort of, when we brought up Moonlight as a potential movie to bring up, I was like, oh, didn't that happen like 2 years ago? Like, we've already sort of done this. But it really not only stands the test of time, but does feel like sort of a trip down memory lane, if you will, and like enough time has passed that I felt it was beautiful to revisit, and I was galled by what I misremembered. I think I misremembered it as being a more, I guess, quote unquote, dramatic and intense and maybe grander than it really was. It was much more intimate, much simpler, much more of sort of these three specific discrete chapters than, I don't know, my brain in the last 5 years put in all this other stuff. I thought, you know, that we saw in my head, I thought that we saw Juan, Mahershala Ali's lovely character, doting drug lord, a daddy. Man, all of the above. I like thought that we like saw him pass away. Like, there were things that I just completely misremembered from the movie that I think emotionally impact that like were I emotionally felt from watching it. But having not seen it in 5 years, I was like, oh, like a lot of things that I thought happened didn't happen. And yet the film was sort of was better for it, for not filling in all the blanks and coloring in all of the lines.
I had a similar thing with the middle chapter of Chiron. I remembered it ending in an act of violence and him getting sent away, but I didn't really remember the details of it that well. And it is still pretty, you know, it's a violent scene that happens. But my memory of that, I think, was more dramatic. Like you were saying, Chris, like it's an intimate and like, it's a movie in which not a lot happens. And I think that's important for the theme of it, that it's like a very everyday story given this huge meaning in the way that the story is told. But I think you're right that it's easy to misremember it as being kind of a huge, sweeping story. It just feels that way. David, what did you remember about Moonlight before diving back into it?
I had a mix of the two experiences. I was surprised that I really had the final chapter in my brain, like beat for beat. It is just such an immaculate, sexy, layered, beautifully acted, really two-hander. I was just everywhere it went, every line of dialogue, I was like, yep, this is exactly how I remember it. And I think that really speaks to how the movie got as far as it did, because it is this beautifully small movie at times, but I think that last chapter, it has this really intense and almost feel-good emotional resonance that carries into a whole different plane, I think. So that was the first takeaway. And then the second was, it's just a small miracle that this movie won Best Picture, honestly.
Yeah.
It's just, it's because it's not, say, 12 Years a Slave, mm-hmm. which was the first movie with a black cast to win Best Picture, and was a very grand, very devastating historical drama.
Yeah.
This is very much a character piece. It's very much an independent film. It can be kind of weird and experimental at times, which mm-hmm. Is not a quality to discount here either. And it's from a director who's, I think, to a lot of the Academy was unknown. And it's just, I think it's a masterpiece. And I'm just so happy that it won and we still get to talk about it.
My hot take, which is not really that hot a take, but in that last act that you were talking about, David, I think Andre Holland is the reason this movie won Best Picture.
Wow.
Trevante Rhodes is incredible in those scenes. And obviously, this movie is a huge accomplishment from Barry Jenkins and mm-hmm. everyone else who's involved in making it. But the way that Andre Holland carries those last scenes and is so, like, tender and thoughtful, and, like, Kevin as a character through the whole movie is kind of this oasis of, like, caring and, you know, confidence in who he is. But the way, like, the energy between the two of them in that last scene, and, like, there's that shot where they're standing in the kitchen, like, 4 feet apart, and you, like, feel that physical space between them. And I think Andre Holland, like, carries a huge amount of that and leaves you feeling so emotional in a movie that's, like, emotional but, like, experimental and, like, not, like, pulling on heartstrings in an obvious way. You feel that ending so strongly, and I think that that translates into votes.
Yeah. I'm going to do you one better. I think it is him and Janelle Monáe.
Oh, my God. She's so good in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
She's so great. And that scene that you're talking about at the end of the – I think it's the last scene of the movie
before
you know, that brief cut back to Little. You know, the last line, or one of the last lines, is Trevante Rhodes' Chiron saying, you know, I haven't been touched by a man since you. Mm-hmm. And the camera just holds on Andre Holland's Kevin, and it is just the way he takes the information in and he really absorbs it and mm-hmm. feels it. And then there's just this slight smile mm-hmm. that's so sweet and understanding. Just really warmed my heart. And then I thought back to a scene in the first third where Janelle Monáe meets Little, and she gets in the car
mm-hmm.
and she just sits there and looks at him, and again just holds the camera on her. It's completely silent, and it's the same thing where she just smiles, and then they cut to him eating very quietly inside. But it's this the images of these other actors just kind of looking at this character mm-hmm. and loving him, and I think communicating what so much and so little is where the movie gets a lot of its power.
Sorry, Chris, I keep cutting you off, but I have to say, they yeah. link him to her character, Teresa, earlier, where he cooks dinner for Chiron at the diner, and he's like, if I cook, you're going to talk. And that's really similar to something she says earlier, like
yes,
when
exactly.
he's eating at their house. So, like, there's a really deliberate link between those two characters. Okay, yep. Chris, yeah. what do you think won this movie Best Picture?
Okay, well, I would add, I mean, this is maybe the not a hot take, but I do think Mahershala Ali falls right in line with that
yeah.
mm-hmm. In terms of just seeing this little boy and taking him in, and just really, and his work is so subtle, and he really is not in that many scenes.
No.
Like, I forgot how few scenes and what an impact, like, he makes with sort of so little. Just really that monologue of taking him. I mean, I think it's, for me, it's the monologue when he teaches him how to swim and how to float and sort of
yep.
how to survive
yep,
in water. And then, you know, black boys looking blue in the moonlight, and that idea. And this hit me in a way that didn't hit me, I guess, 5 or 6 years ago when it came out. But blue as a color, but blue is also a feeling and also a state of being mm-hmm. and also mm. like, you know, an emotional state as well. Just really wrecked me this time. So I got Barry Jenkins' cinematography in terms of just lingering and giving space to, you know, to having Janelle Monáe and Andre Holland and Mahershala Ali simply take in Little or mm-hmm. Black or Chiron was really beautiful. I did want to add too, which is kind of lovely, given that this is a queer movie and a queer, you know, story, that Janelle Monáe has since come out as non-binary, you know, which is
yeah.
really fantastic. And, you know, that has sort of nothing to do with the character that she portrays in the film, but just is a little like, oh, like a little Easter egg, like a little, oh, like, you know, there was some queer energy, you know, in there from the get-go. But I was really blown away by Mahershala with how much he did with so little. And I do want to say, as for the three actors that play Chiron, Trevante Rhodes, Ashton Sanders, and the little boy, Alex Hibbert, the way that they, and I remember being blown away by this in 2016, but the way that they eat, the idiosyncratic, like the little way that they eat, every time that they're eating, because each of them has a scene where they're eating food, I was blown away by the detail with how they embodied each other so well. Mm-hmm. You could just see the through line of this person. It's really some of the best like casting and acting directing in terms of keeping this one character the same sort of like soul and mannerisms, just the way shoveling, the way they shoveled food in their mouth, the way they held the fork. I was just like, oh my God, this is attention to detail. This is directing. This is acting.
Yeah.
So I was really just sort of bowled over by that small element of it.
I noticed that when, you know, you first meet adult Chiron and he's become Mahershala Ali's one. Like, he's kind of stepping into the role of this, like, semi-benevolent drug dealer, and you see him kind of teaching a younger guy, and he's wearing, you know, he's, like, dressed the same, driving a really similar car. And then he transforms into young Chiron when he goes and sees Kevin again. And the way that transformation happens on his face is really remarkable. And like you said, Chris, like, it's a feat of acting, but directing and, like, just care and Barry Jenkins knowing every single thing that he wanted to come across on camera and not having to highlight it and just letting it be there and be so powerful.
I do think we shouldn't forget to talk about Naomi Harris, who plays Chiron's mother, who did get an Oscar nomination for her work as Chiron's mother, who I, again, remembered as being more of a, you know, quote unquote antagonist sort of villain character than she really was. And I do, I will say that the scene that I remembered sort of beat for beat was their final scene when she visits him, or when he visits her back in Florida. And she sort of says that she'll always love him and apologizes.
She's like working at a rehab center, basically,
yes,
right?
Yes, working at a rehab facility, a rehab facility center, and is ostensibly clean or at least off drugs at that juncture. And her like tearful apology, and speaking of people taking things in, you know, and how Trevante Rhodes took that in and took that information in, and you know, the silent teardrops that fell, and their sort of reconciliation and the idea of forgiveness was really powerful. And I know she's still working and she works a bunch. I mean, I think of her sort of as a it's funny because I think of her like in this movie and I think of her in James Bond and not as much in between. But I really do think it's sort of a prickly, unlikable in parts, tricky character to play. I thought she found the humanity in that and did a really great job. And she's British, which always is, you know, that's always crazy to me when that happens. So
she and Mahershala Ali reunited in Swan Song last year, which I had forgotten about until just now looking at her Wikipedia. I saw the movie. She's good in it. You know, she's still working a lot.
Yeah.
Happy.
She is so good in this movie. I mean, even in that scene too, just the way she is kind of struggling to light the cigarette, which can be a bad addict trope in a lot of movies, but it's really rooted in her anxiety in the scene and her pain in the scene. And I don't know, I just was really struck by the way she played that. And it was just so kind of heartbreaking and intense to watch her try to get through that moment.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like I remember the story about her being in the movie is that like she was only on set for like a week.
Yes.
And she got like cast late. Like her work in this is kind of even more miraculous when you consider that.
I think it was like 2 or 3 days even. I don't want to misspeak, but I totally remember that was a big part of her campaign was like, I got there. I think I had like 4 days on set, shot all my scenes and was gone. And I was like, I didn't even know movies could be made that way.
But we all learned a lot.
We have learned a lot since 2016.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, here. So she was doing press for Bond. I was traveling all over. I think I flew in from Mexico. I was in a different city every 3 days, and she was on the set for 3 days. That's nuts.
3 days. That is actually nuts.
I know.
That's wild. Ugh.
Ever wanted to go inside the Met Gala? I'm Cho Minardi, and this week on The Run Through Vogue, we take you inside the world's most exclusive and glamorous party. We'll talk about the best looks from the red carpet and everything that happened after. Listen to The Run Through Vogue wherever you get your podcasts.
So should we look back at this movie's Oscar history? Because it really is It's a fascinating story, even before you get to the La La Land mix-up. And this was something I was learning, listening back to our old episodes of this podcast. Even, like, the week before the Oscars, we were like, well, you know, like, Moonlight would be a really exciting win, but I just don't know. And I think it's the movie that started to teach us that something that is small but makes people feel passionate can win, which is what happened with Coda, what happened with Parasite. It felt like the first example of that. To me, Spotlight feels different, though maybe we can debate that. I mean, David, you were also covering Oscars back then. What is your memory of how the Moonlight surge happened?
My memory was I was completely shocked. I just remember, where was I working at the time? I think I was at Slate, and I just remember the Slack channel going completely insane. And I think I was on like a 30 second delay, which happens so often with these streams. And so I was like, wait, what what's happening? Because it was literally while the La La Land people were just on the stage. Mm-hmm. But no, I think in terms of the trajectory of that race, La La Land always felt like a pretty uneasy but strong frontrunner, kind of in the way we talked about Power of the Dog, which was, you know, who would unseat it? Definitely Moonlight was the critic's favorite. It was the passion pick, but, you know, it was nominated for SAG Ensemble. And like Power of the Dog, La La Land was not, which was the first big warning sign. But Moonlight lost to Hidden Figures. And so I think Hidden Figures started to emerge as the, well, maybe this is the feel-good.
It was a huge hit, like right at the time that the Oscars were happening.
Yeah. What a year for Janelle Monáe.
I know.
I am upset she was not nominated for one of those movies, because I think Octavia Spencer was nominated for Hidden Figures. And I love Octavia Spencer, but I think Janelle Monáe really steals that movie too. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I digress. So I think that in the end, you probably had a really close race. Like, I think in the end, based on the way the Academy votes, comparatively, Coda won that race pretty comfortably. But I don't know that Moonlight had that kind of room.
Yeah.
It didn't win Producers Guild. It didn't win Directors Guild. It really was kind of on its own as an Oscar winner and a Golden Globe winner, I should say.
Because La La Land won musical or comedy.
Right. There was able to be the separation. So I think in the end, it really was, I totally agree with you, Katie, that first instance of an upset being pulled off by a movie that, you know, 10 years earlier, you wouldn't think would be able to win that award.
Or be nominated.
Or even be nominated by the sheer scale of it and the resources. This was also the first win for A24. You know, there's a lot of firsts with this movie.
Wow. That, I have to come out and say, and this is a controversial statement, I honestly loved the movie La La Land. I mean, I really
that's
did.
Not, I think that's controversial.
I feel like now it might be, but I really did loved Emma Stone's performance in it and like really, really loved it. But I adored and loved, and, you know, Moonlight was on a whole different level. So I remember just as a, you know, as a lay person, just someone who followed Gold Derby and listened to this podcast even, really being like, oh, you know what, you know, it's probably gonna be La La Land, which is good, but it'd be amazing if Moonlight could sort of, you know, eke it out somehow. But it seemed sort of like La La Land, I mean, a la Power of the Dog, a little too big to fail. But this was, I remember I was sitting on my cousin's couch when the Michigas happened, and I could not, we were screaming. We could not believe it when the mix-up happened. But we were sort of screaming with joy rather than with anguish, as I'm sure many others were.
Uh-huh. I mean, my story of where I was is that we were doing a live stream at the Oscar party, and we had like this back room with like a carpet that had gotten wet and smelled terrible. And it was me and Mike Hogan, who was hosting Little Gold Men with me then, and Phoebe Robinson, who was now way too big a deal to do anything like that with us. But she was hosting it with us, and we like saw them announced La La Land and kind of all like turned to our notes, because we were going to start this live stream immediately after the Oscars ended, and then slowly like started looking back up being like, what, and then went on the air like 30 seconds later just like trying to figure out what to say. And that was the end of my career in live television for obvious reasons.
What a way to go.
I mean, the other thing to remember about these Oscars is that it was spring 2017. Shit had gotten really crazy when Trump got elected in 2016. And like the way that we all psychologically processed the 2016 election and then this mix-up, which is, you know, certainly lower stakes, but just as like, wait, is the earth still round? Like, what is reality? That was a lot to take in a 6-month period.
And I do think it had an impact for sure.
In that Trump's election had an impact in Moonlight's win?
I do think Moonlight is, I don't like calling it a feel-good movie, but it does, it's not a difficult sit. Like, perhaps it could be painted just based on, you know, reading a log line
sure.
or something. But I do think that coming into the back half of that award season, the 2017 part, after the holiday, there was probably a sense of recognizing something more for its importance, its weight, than how it makes you feel.
And for challenging the status quo.
And for challenging, exactly. And for representing a step forward, for representing something, for being something in Hollywood that's incredibly groundbreaking and progressive and, yeah, a counter to what was happening outside of the town.
Yeah, so. A win for the little guy. Yeah.
Really. Yeah. Well, it was also a year after Oscar So White, which I had sort of misremembered. I think I got Oscar So White and Me Too a little bit mixed up in my head, and I hadn't realized that it had happened before this. And, you know, the year before it had been all white acting nominees, and this year it was markedly more diverse. And I think that was certainly on the minds of a lot of voters in terms of wanting to challenge the status quo, like we said.
Yeah. Do you, either of you, remember anything specific that A24 did to sort of campaign, like any, you know, like any events or anything? Because I'm like now so interested in like sort of how they spread the word, because it feels like a movie that a lot of Academy voters might not have pressed play on, you know, necessarily, but ostensibly they had to because they saw it and loved it, you know, at the end of the day.
I just remember very generally, like early conversations, it was a movie that, you know, first they had really strong strategists attached to it who didn't work at A24. And they really believed that it could go all the way. And I think this kind of kickstarted the era too of, like, you know, a neon winning for Parasite of specialty newer studios realizing they can go all the way if you attach the right people, have the right movie. I think especially in the case of newer studios, you need a really unimpeachable choice to run with it. But yeah, I think it was honestly just having a ton of faith, and being new means you can try different things and be a little bit more scrappy. And as we saw with Apple and Coda, obviously they don't have Apple's resources, but, you know, being able to invest entirely in one contender. And we've talked a lot about, say, Netflix having so many contenders the last few years. Obviously, by the end, all attention was on Power of the Dog, but when it's just so singularly, this movie can go all the way, that can make a big difference.
Yeah.
I, listening to our old episodes, I was reminded that, like, Mark Duplass wrote a whole open letter about how much he loved Moonlight and Justin Chang.
Oh, my God,
LA
I
Times
remember that.
Okay, I did not know that.
I think there were really genuine, like, genuine word of mouth efforts of people saying, like, I love this movie. You have to watch this movie. And by then, A24 is definitely building its vibe of being really cool. Like, the year before, they had Amy nominated at the Oscars, the documentary, and then also Room, which just overperformed like crazy. Like, Lenny Abramson got that Best Director nomination. So they clearly had a way to reach out to the people to get them to pay attention. And David, you said earlier, like, Moonlight is this critic's favorite. So I think even if you're like, oh, the movie sounds like such a bummer, like, you do have to pay attention to it. And all those factors really kind of came together perfectly.
Yeah, that happens every year. Like a Drive My Car, that movie would not have been nominated for anything outside of international film if the critics did not really pinpoint it as the movie to champion.
And Parasite too, right?
Parasite too, yeah, that can take a movie a long way. Mm.
Do we think, watching Moonlight, do we think that it has influenced movies that have come after it? Or is Barry Jenkins such a singular filmmaker? Not that he has, like, a style that, like, you would know it if you saw it in a second, but, like, I couldn't think of much that has looked like Moonlight other than Underground Railroad and If Beale Street Could Talk. What am I forgetting? It might not be.
I was sort of, not that Barry Jenkins is the first person to put movies into chapters, you know, but I do feel like that is sort of, I was like, oh, this is like worst. I can't believe I thought this was like,
worst,
oh, this is
the
worst person in the world. I was like, that's not how I should be conceiving of it. But I was like, oh, that sort of device. And just the art, like, melding sort of an art house-y, more creative take or directing style with sort of a grounded story. I don't know. I feel like I can't think of, like, another director that I'm like, oh, he's in the Barry Jenkins school of directing. So I guess Jenkins remains sort of singular. But it feels like he created this whole moment, this indie film, this like vibe, this A24. I mean, I don't really think of A24 as Room or Amy as much as I, you know, enjoyed those films. I feel like that was like Moonlight is what kicked off the craze, or like, you know, that sort of the whole vibe, if you will, for me.
Well,
so
looking at the A24 Wikipedia page, I was going to throw out Minari as maybe in the footsteps of Moonlight, as like a personal story with a like distinct directorial view that's still got kind of this like family element.
I think that's a good,
it.
Yeah. That's a good, I think that's a good comparison.
Corollary, yeah.
Yeah. Actually, that movie's another good example of how hard it is to go back to what we were talking about at the beginning, how hard it is to make a movie that feels so small and so big at the same time. That's not really something you can replicate. It's just, I think, talent and having the right story, and even to an extent hitting at the right moment.
Yeah. Timing is everything.
Moonlight is, I think, you know, a masterpiece no matter when it comes out. Does it win, you know, if it comes out in the middle of the Obama era? I don't know the answer to that. But
that is a great thought experiment.
Yeah, it's worth pondering, but for the sole reason of Moonlight, I am glad. For the sole reason of Moonlight winning, I'm glad it came out when it did, even though it had to fight against horrible political narratives.
Yeah. I mean, looking at the, so I'm now on the Wikipedia page for the 2016 Oscars, and just looking at what Moonlight won and what it didn't win, you know, it loses cinematography to La La Land, which, like, I guess. It loses score to La La Land, which I want to, like, throw something at the wall. I mean, this is also the year
Patel.
I mean, I like La La Land, too. Like, I think there's a lot of wins I would give to it. But also, this is the year that Moana loses Best Original Song. That's a movie that's been playing on a loop in my house lately, and that song is so good. And also, this is the year that it's, like, 8 really good Best Picture nominees, and then Hacksaw Ridge, which is like really
good. Andrew Garfield, the only thing good you can say about that.
His first Oscar nomination.
I know. Now we can just talk about Tick, Tick, Boom instead. Also, remembering that this is the year that Amy Adams gets snubbed for Arrival, which remains one of the more bonkers Oscar snubs ever.
Yeah, that was crazy. For Florence Foster Jenkins, sorry.
And didn't even Villeneuve gets nominated for Best Director. It's crazy.
He was nominated.
Yeah, it's a really interesting Oscar year in so many different ways.
Yeah.
Well, we're wrapping up our Pride Month flashbacks, you guys. Any final thoughts on what we've learned? Are you already thinking about what we should do next year? I don't think we've fully exhausted the Oscar Pride history, as limited as that history may be.
It is limited.
Every month should be Pride Month. Everyone should be Oscar Pride Month. I think it's so fascinating. I've learned so much. I mean, in and out, and going and talking about movies that we didn't even talk about, you know, Philadelphia and whatnot. There is sort of a, you know, a secret history here that hopefully is becoming, that I would say is becoming sort of less secret and more part of the mainstream culture of the Oscars. But it is really, I find it fascinating to revisit it. And now I have all these new movies that I need to go and watch, which is fantastic.
Yeah, it's a great time to watch old movies.
I think that when you talk about, especially like history of gay Hollywood, and I think I went into this month of recording a little bit nervous about how some of these movies would hold up. And it was really fascinating to me that they all really held up. Like Chris, you mentioned In-N-Out, which obviously I know holds up because I've seen it like 100 times. But, you know, even talking about Rebel Without a Cause or Philadelphia, we didn't talk about Philadelphia, but I did watch it over the past month. These are movies that, yes, they were made in a specific time. The way we understood and talked about gay identity, queer identity was very different, but they have a real place in how we talk about Hollywood now too, and I think that that's a really good takeaway for what we covered and what we kind of found between them. Yeah, I love doing it. I'm really
well. Same time next year, guys. Well, see you back here next June.
See you there.
That does it for this week's show. I'll be gone next week, but David and Richard will be taking over in my stead. In the meantime, find us at vanityfair.com. David's still doing some great coverage of the studios and the streamers and where they stand as the Emmy race wraps up, which I think you guys, or the Emmy nominations race wraps up, which you guys can talk more about next week. You can find us on Twitter at Little Gold Men, and on our own, I'm at Katie Rich, and David.
David Canfield 97.
And Chris.
Chris Triss.
You can also sign up to text with us at joinsubtext.com/littlegoldmen or text 213-513-7215. Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the phrase on the lips of every Academy member now goes to Chris Murphy.
I really do want to see Billie Eilish's ballot.
I'm Nomi Fry, and this week on Critics at Large, we're talking about the delights and shortcomings of the new movie Challengers. It starred Zendaya at the center of a tennis triangle and a very steamy love triangle.
Who are her loyalties to? Will she be tempted by the other one? How do these guys reckon their professional playing ambition with the romantic and sexual feelings about this mysterious woman? And such we have it. We have a conflict between three people in a game meant for two.
Is it a sports movie or a sex movie? Find out on Critics at Large from The New Yorker. New episodes drop every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.